Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. So today is the second weekday of the KSFR Fall Fun Drive, and we are setting our goal this hour for $1,500. So we are asking you to call in and make a contribution to KSFR at 505-428-1393. I have here at the table in the Santa Fe Baking Company, Tom Johnson. He's the co-founder of the Institute for Analytic Journalism, and we're going to be talking about journalism, analytic journalism specifically, the open data movement, and all kinds of good things. You are a donor to KSFR, to public radio. Why?
Not only to KSFR, but also KCSM and KQED in San Francisco, where I lived for 30-plus years. The value of public radio is that stations like KSFR are local, and it's a very rare occurrence these days when you have somebody who actually lives in the town, lives in the community, and therefore has that special connection to be able to report on what is happening in the community. And that's why the Radio Cafe specifically is so important to Santa Fe.
You listen to this program?
I do listen to this program, oftentimes not when it's coming on live. I'm not a morning guy, but...
To the podcast?
Once in a while I will Yay! Listen to the podcast, but also I'm a big jazz fan, and so I really appreciate the format, the music format of KSFR.
428-1393, 428-1393 is the number in the 505 area code. The number of the... toll-free number is 866-907-5737, 866-907-KSFR. We're asking you to call, we're asking you to donate, asking you to contribute, asking you to keep this public radio station alive. Now, we need to hear the ringing of phones. We will hear the ringing of phones. We also hear a little bit of background noise here in the cafe. We're in the Santa Fe Baking Company. I sent out an email to lots of friends of the show. If you want to be on that email list, by the way, you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org, and you can also look at Facebook. But I have made a commitment to make chocolate chip cookies, and so if you come into the cafe next week, we have to make an appointment, but if you make a donation, you can get the cookies. Okay. 428-1393 is the number, and this station is very important. If you think it is, give us a call. 428-1393. Go for it. So let's talk about this Institute for Analytic Journalism. What is it? What's it all about?
Well, basically, it gets at the tries to address the issues that are deeply rooted in the digital revolution. We're in the very, very early years of this change in how humanity communicates, how it creates data and information, how it extracts information from data, and how it passes it on to other people. Without going into too much of a lecture on it, I think this is the fourth revolution in actually the history of humanity.
What are the first three?
Well, the first one happened about 1.8 or 9 million years ago, when some hominid stood up and was consciously able to distinguish between me and thee, and language starts to evolve. But then we went for a very, very long time, a couple of million years, until we started to do symbology.
So that first one was kind of the Garden of Eden?
The first one was
for getting out of it?
The consciousness, the development of consciousness and getting out of it. That's right. Then we started to develop symbology, painting on walls, carving into bones, etc., etc. That was the second one. The third one, coming about 5,000 years ago, when somebody picked up a stick and started writing in some wet clay, and cuneiform evolves. And so from cuneiform, it, out of that evolves the use of the alphabet, and we could argue that's maybe the third and a half resolution, but the similarities of those were that if you had reasonable vision and were literate in reading those symbols, you could survive and you could pass information on to other generations.
And as David Krakauer said in this very interesting series of lectures about intelligence at the Santa Fe Institute lecture series the other night, once you are able to put things down in writing, it becomes kind of your exo-brain. In other words, what you have is not only in your mind, it's written down, and you can multiply by untold orders of magnitude what you know and what you can let other people
that's
know.
That's right. So simply by arranging, in case of the English alphabet, to 26 letters, or in the Spanish alphabet, 28, 29, and so forth. The interesting thing is that you can, even if you don't know the language, and if you have the base for a language, you can tease information out of those structures. For example, when I have a lecture, I have a headline from a Spanish newspaper in El Salvador that says in Spanish, 100% de la población sufre enferma mental. Well, even if you don't know Spanish, if you know a Latin-based language, you can look at that 1 and the 00 and the percent sign and start to reach toward meaning for what that says.
Which is?
Which is 100% of the people in El Salvador are crazy, and all my friends in El Salvador pointed that headline and said, yes, that's exactly, finally the press got it right. But what happens with the digital revolution is that when content is created digitally, it's all ones and zeros, and it's just a string of ones and zeros. And even a very, very, very good programmer can't look at that string just taking a random chunk and tease information out of that. So we need a whole new set of tools to be able to take those ones and zeros and display them on a device like the laptop computer that we're looking at right now.
Did you miss the printing press?
The printing press is an extension of the handwritten calligraphy from the illuminated manuscripts. Yes, it's an innovation, and it's important.
It's a huge revolution, though, I mean, in terms of dissemination.
Well, but not one of the big four, in my view. Yes, it absolutely made big changes, but if you could read an illuminated manuscript, now you could read the Bible that was printed by Gutenberg without having any new skills.
So this digital revolution, what it means above all, is that information is available to people all over the world instantly, and so we can access far more than we ever could before, and practically anybody can access it. On the other hand, what do we access? How do we know what to access? What do we do with it? Who's doing the accessing? What does it really get us?
Exactly. First off, I draw a distinction between data and information. We start with data of all kinds. It could be visual, it could be audio, it could be alphabetic data, but we have to analyze that data, and from the results of that analysis, information emerges. Information, by definition, being that which helps us make a decision. That's my definition, but you can find many other people define it. All right, if we have something that helps us make a decision, what about what? Well, it could be about the kind of car that I'm going to buy. It's going to be about where do I get the cheapest prices to rent an apartment, etc., etc. It also can have to do with how are my elected representatives performing or not performing. What that means is we have to start asking questions about that data. Who created it and why and when? Who can edit that data? Who approved its posting up in the public sphere or not? Who is keeping it from being posted? Those kinds of issues. Then we have to ask, what tools do I need to analyze that data? If you're looking at digital data, there's somewhere between 400 and 500 different file types that are used for different professions. For example, the transportation profession creates a special file to measure the time of travel between bus stops. So stop A to stop B is one time, but maybe you want the time of travel between A and E. Those kinds of things. And as I say, it requires special tools to analyze it. So it's this whole new environment that we're living in that raises all kinds of new questions about survival.
Are you talking about the environment full of buses or the digital environment?
No, the digital environment, the datasphere.
Right.
And we are all species living in that datasphere, just like we're species living in the ecosphere. And we take in data from that environment, we analyze it, we put information out, which returns back into the datasphere for other species to use.
You're the co-founder of the Institute for Analytic Journalism, and the reality is, and I don't care what anybody says, we don't have the tools, most of us, to analyze data like that on our own. And even if we have the tools, we don't have the time to do it all. So we basically have to rely on other people whom we trust to do it for us. And so the question arises, what is journalism doing in terms of dealing with the amount of data available and interpreting it and making it meaningful for us as citizens?
Well, there seem to be at least two major trends that are happening over time. Remember that most journalism, both print and broadcast journalism, is really a manufacturing process. It's an assembly line. And so if you work at a newspaper, you go in the morning and the assembly line is already running and you know what your job is on that assembly line. It might be to write the obituaries, to create or manufacture the obituaries, and you write them up and then you pass them on to the next person in the assembly line. It might be to be covering the courts, police beat, whatever it is. At the end of the day, all of those different parts are assembled into a thing we call a newspaper, and it gets printed and put on the loading dock, and out it goes for distribution. And then we come back tomorrow on the assembly line, and we do the same thing all over again. What has happened is that while that has been going on, traditionally the great cost, the great expense for a journalism operation has been in the printing and the distribution of the product, not in creating the product. What has happened in the digital revolution is that that equation has flipped. So now to do good journalism takes a lot of time, and that of a reporter's time and editor's time, which is expensive. The cost of manufacturing that product and distributing the product falls towards zero. Because if I produce one online newspaper, the cost of a million people reading that is the same as the cost for one person to read
right.
it. So journalism generally has lagged in understanding the need to invest in training and new skills and new techniques at the beginning of that whole manufacturing process.
So what are those new skills and new techniques?
Well, it involves first, how do we find and retrieve the data which is appropriate for a story? For example, recently we've seen a couple things here in New Mexico. One of them was involving the expenditures on the credit cards used by the members of the PRC. There has been some back and forth between the Attorney General's office and the chairman of the PRC as to whether or not that data should be released. Well, if a reporter is working on that, he or she should have access to all of that data just per force. You shouldn't have to request it from the PRC. It should just be up there. I'll go into a variety of reasons why that should be. If the reporter can get that data, then the question becomes, well, in what form is that data and how do I analyze it? Now, predominantly in not just New Mexico, but in most government agencies, they supply the data in a file type called a PDF, portable document format. That gives you access to the document, but not to the data. Let's say you want to look at a spreadsheet or an account sheet of all the expenditures from the PRC. Well, you have to go to at least two extra steps to take that PDF, to extract the data from the PDF format and put it into something like a spreadsheet so you can start to sort the data and see, well, which of the commissioners has spent the most and what is on what topics or where, whatever it might be. That takes a whole new set of skill, both first finding the data, retrieving it down to your desktop, extracting the data from the PDF, getting it into a spreadsheet, and then using the tools in the spreadsheet to start to tease some meaning out of that.
We're talking to Tom Johnson, co-founder of the Institute for Analytic Journalism. And the phones are ringing. We have over $250 so far on our way to our $1,500 goal. The number is 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393. That number. And Mary Lynn has a report from the control room.
Yes, lots of thanks. Jane Hanna, Don Knieper, Wesley Bradford, Angela Culbertson, Orlando Diaz, Howard Gross, who loves your show, Mary Charlotte, in the
Thank
Morning
you.
Radio Cafe, and of course, Diane Karp,
Yay.
our very Very supportive listener here to KSFR, Diane Karp and Karen Cohen. And one of these people, I'm not quite sure who it is, I'll find out next time, contributed enough for three tickets to Juan Gonzalez's talk that he's going to give here at the Armory on Tuesday, October 25th, Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now, and with his latest book, and said that the next three callers who are first-time callers, may have one of those tickets. So we'll give away three, so three different people. First-time caller, any contribution to KSFR and the Radio Cafe. Thanks.
Yay. Okay. Keep those phones ringing, 428-1393, 428-1393. Now, Tom Johnson, when you look at the journalistic landscape, what is the advantage that public radio and independent media have over commercial and corporate broadcast media in terms of journalism?
Well, primarily, I think it's the fact that you hit independent media. What we've seen in recent years is a huge consolidation, mergers and acquisitions of radio stations, especially where they are controlled by the home office in San Antonio, Texas, wherever it might be, and they are all being programmed remotely, or certainly programmed at a distance, and then oftentimes, especially music stations, are being played remotely. So what you miss there is this the deep roots into a community, which the Radio Cafe provides. The fact is that San Antonio is a city different, is a unique city, and
yeah.
We have this intellectual...
San Antonio.
Did I say San Antonio?
You did. I thought you meant every... No. Because what you're saying is also true. Every city that has a public radio station, Santa Fe, San Antonio, San Francisco, all the saints...
That's right. They're unique and need their local, and the local people, such as yourself, are able to tap into that. When my wife and I first started living here part-time, at least almost 20 years ago, we thought, well, there's not a big university in Santa Fe, and that's a shortcoming. Well, what we've found is that the city itself is a university. And in this community, you literally could put together a world-class university with faculty in just about every discipline, just by drawing on the people who live here in this small town. Now, the KSFR reflects that, I think, not only on shows like this and Diego's in the afternoon, but also the kind of call-in and conversations that happen during this time when we are raising funds. So I'm very pleased that I'm able to make some contributions to the independence of media here in Santa Fe.
428-1393 is the number. The phones are ringing. Keep them ringing hard and loud and mellifluously. 428-1393 or 1-866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. That's the toll-free number. And make your vote for independent journalism. Make your vote for KSFR, for the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And thank you to all the people. It was just wonderful to hear that list of names. Some people I know, some I don't know. It's just great to hear you. Please keep those phones ringing. 428-1393. Go for it. One of the things, to get back to what you were saying a moment ago about weather data that is, especially public data that has to do with our government. We pay taxes so that there is government, then they do things, and in theory we should be able to know what those things are, and
right.
Reporters and the public should be able to know those things in detail. And, okay, so you get something that's in a PDF format, and it's not in a spreadsheet format. Now let's say it were in a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet format. What's to keep just a good or even mediocre adequate hacker from going in and changing that data and re-uploading it? The chaos that even I, who am not a particularly mischievous person, could imagine wreaking on public databases and public information sites is infinite.
There are two issues here. One is that people say, government people say, well, we put it up as PDF so people can't do this,
yeah,
can't
exactly.
modify it. Well, in fact, it's a trivial matter to create a new or a bogus PDF that looks and feels and would seem to have the correct data. That's not an issue. The counterintuitive aspect of all of this is that if you create a file, and let's say it's in a spreadsheet format, the wider you can distribute that file to more different computers or servers, the more likely it is that that file can be checked if somebody has manipulated it. There are any number of programs available out there that are open source that you can compare file A to file B to file C and all of the different versions, and it will kick it out to you and say, hey, wait a minute, this one is substantially different. And you can set the degree of substantiality. How different does it need to be before you get an alert on it? So, as I say, it seems counterintuitive to preserve the validity of a file by distributing it in a much wider basis.
You are giving a talk, actually tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Complex here in Santa Fe at 7:15, called Hey, It's the People's Data, the Global Emergence of the Open Data Movement. Now, this is what you're talking about here, is the open data movement.
Yeah, in some ways it is. The more people you have looking at documents, the greater security you have, I believe. I got onto this topic last spring. I was doing some journalism, training some journalists in England, and we had students from 32 different countries, South Africa, France, Belgium, even Bulgaria. And they were the ones who turned me on to, hey, do you know what's going on here? The open data movement used to be referred to as transparency.
Uh-huh.
And as language evolves, now it is just generally called the open data movement.
Which is a very different metaphor.
Yes, it is. Because it implies retrieval and analysis of the data, not just looking at it, I think.
Not just looking through a clear window.
What's happened are a couple of things. Is that first you have a cohort of people, generally I would say under 40, who have grown up with in this data sphere, this digital environment, who have a variety of skills in identifying and retrieving the data and analyzing it. Secondly, through worldwide communications, they start to see the value of connectivity and collaborative analytic work. A couple of examples come to mind. About a year and a half ago now, maybe 2 years, the Telegraph in the UK, in London, got hold of 500,000 PDF sheets of members of Parliament's expenditures. Now, because these were in PDF and because there were so many of them, the newspaper or no single institution would have the potential to analyze that. So what the Telegraph and I think the Guardian was involved did was that they put all of these documents up on the web, and they invited people to come in and look, because you can search PDFs, come in and look for the documents related to your member of Parliament. Different people took different numbers of pages, etc., but did the analysis on it of about, last time I looked, about 270,000 of those pages. There's still more to be done. The result of that was that they turned up all kinds of members of Parliament who were having their patio built or their garden wall being redone, etc., on their home.
With public funds.
With public funds. And people have certainly resigned, but others have actually gone to jail. Well, that was one of the things which was picked up worldwide.
So that's fascinating.
It was. It was this sort of social analysis of it by non-traditional I don't want to say journalists, but people who are doing the analysis. Related to the open data now, we see it being driven, sparked by the Arab Spring. So the people in the square in Cairo, Tahrir Square, were using cell phones to communicate. And it wasn't data per se, but it was the idea of collaboration and collaborative work. And then when the government finally did fall, people were going in to start to get at the data. About that same time, I noticed that there were, in the same week, the last week of May, there were three open data hackathons where interested people...
Were they really called that?
Yeah, interested people, and this is what was, to me, interesting, people in Poland, Mexico, and Guatemala we're putting out the call for interested people to come together and let's go see the data that we can get available on our government, and then we'll work on the tools for both analyzing and presenting the results of that. Subsequently, because the data sphere is like living in its own universe, if you enter a different galaxy, it's a little different. So in recent months, I've been watching this kind of thing in the galaxy of open data happen, and I'm amazed at some of the content that have come up in these listservs. For example, one here, somebody sent out a message the end of September. She said, I would like to get together with open data members from South Sudan, the Philippines, and South Caucasus region to see what is being done in those areas in terms of open data. So there you go. It's global.
It's global, and yet what happens to the results of that data? Okay, the analysis is done in Poland or Mexico or Guatemala or Bulgaria or wherever, and who disseminates that to the average person who's taking their kids to work in the morning and trying to survive?
Yeah. Because we're so early in this whole new phase of humanity, in this digital phase, this is a very dynamic time, so that people who today might not know they want any of that data or information, tomorrow might. But keep in mind that the open data movement is certainly not about the technology, and it's not about building a portal for people to get to it solely, and it's not transparency just for the sake of transparency. What is coming to the surface is that if governments make their data available on the web, if the default is to make the data available instead of how little can we give out, but rather we're going to assume we're going to give it all out, then what we start to see is increased internal efficiency and effectiveness in the governments. For example, I have a good friend who works in the library for the at the Museum of Archaeology. The way the state of New Mexico's system is set up, she has to use two different databases, but they don't talk to each other, and they should be different cataloging databases. Or you have people in the government who are worried about keeping people out of sites. So consequently, there was one point about a year ago where she couldn't get into the Encyclopedia Britannica without jumping through security hoops. It's that mindset,
right,
that says keep people from the data. So we have to flip that around to understand that among the functions of government, and this is really new, the purpose of government is to create and share its data with the people, along with providing for public security and infrastructure and conduct elections and all that. Today, government's role is to give people their data. Secondly, we see with open data that as this stuff starts to come to the surface, there's increased citizen participation and inclusion through offering services or better services to the people. So something as simple as reporting where the potholes are in the city.
Right.
If you have every, and Mayor Koss has been very good on this, if you have this device where everybody can go and pass that information on to the government, the results are greater efficiency in getting that.
That's
kind
interesting.
Of thing
I
fixed.
Mean, that's a very simple thing. If there's a way to go online and report the basic things like where a speed bump is needed or
yeah.
where a pothole is.
That's right. They're also, and this is one thing, is that we're seeing increased economic benefits. New businesses and opportunities arise as government is shared. This is probably best shown by the U.S. Census Bureau's data, which goes back to the beginning of the Republic. I mean, it's mentioned in the Constitution that we're going to take this census every 10 years. But the data that's in that census, I submit, drives more economic decisions in this country than anything else. It drives decisions about where you're going to start a new business. It drives decisions about where are we going to locate our schools, about the quality of health care. All of that kind of stuff is there. So to the degree that we can share government data from all levels, we will find new uses for it, and we will find new people developing tools to access and use that data.
We're talking to Tom Johnson of the Institute for Analytic Journalism. And the phones have been ringing. 428-1393 is the number to keep those phones ringing. Let's get a report from Mary Lynn in the control room. Okay, we're going to get a report in a moment from Mary Lynn in the control room. Last time I heard, we had already reached our halfway mark on our goal to $1,500 for this morning. Maybe we can get there. Maybe we can surpass that goal.
Yeah, we're more than halfway there, over 800 so far.
Excellent.
And several thank yous. Some of them are here right now with me. Margot Chavez.
Yay.
And she loves the Radio Cafe. And Lucy Moore.
Yay.
Of course, these are all your fans.
Thank
Carolyn
you.
Carolyn Frazier.
Thank you.
And Victor Alvarez.
Ache.
I know he'll know. I don't know what that means. He said that to you, too.
Yeah, well, it's a Cuban thing.
Okay.
428-1393 is the number, so we're more than halfway to our goal of $1,500 for this hour. We can get there, surpass it. Yesterday we surpassed it. It was a wonderful day, and it's a great day on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe with Tom Johnson. Now, we were talking when we took a little break earlier about media consolidation and the problems of consolidation and how they affect the media. And I wanted you to say more about that.
Well, the consolidation is within the media industry itself. For example, Comcast, most people think of Comcast as just being its cable provider, or in many cases its internet and sometimes telephone provider. But in fact, Comcast is today the largest of all of the media forms. It, among the television stations that Comcast owns, is NBC. Universal Studios, NBC Universal Domestic Distribution. Then they own, Comcast owns stations in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, the San Francisco Bay Area, Dallas-Fort Worth, on down, probably about 10 of them. So these are the major television broadcasting markets. Additionally, Comcast owns Telemundo and the various stations there that are all over the country and largely Spanish-speaking communities.
I should know all this.
It goes on and on and on. Comcast owns Bravo. Comcast owns CNBC. So you get that kind of consolidation in the media, but also in the last 20 years especially, we have seen mergers and acquisitions in just about all sectors of the economy in the United States. The financial is the obvious one, so
right.
the banks and financial institutions that are too large to fail. We see consolidations in retail, like department stores, where you used to have Macy's and Dillard's and JCPenney's and Sears and Roebuck all operating in malls. And when you had that locally, many of those kind of dry goods stores or big stores, big box stores even, would set aside a certain portion of their local profits to put back into the community, to things such as independent radio stations and public radio stations. Well, as that consolidation has taken place, two things have happened. One is that you do not have these stores competing and buying advertising in local newspapers or on local radio or television, which meant that the newspapers and the local broadcast stations didn't have the funds to put into good, solid, in-depth reporting, which is always time-consuming and expensive.
Exactly. So if you don't have five department stores, you don't have five full-page display ads because they're competing against each other.
Right.
So that's the virtue of competition, which is erased by monopoly.
That's right. And as you get consolidation in the automobile industries, whereas you used to have a Dodge dealer and you used to have a Ford dealer and you used to have a Lincoln Mercury dealer all buying ads in the newspapers especially or on television, now you have a one-stop Ford full Ford line dealership, which is not spending as much. So that means that not only is the power shifting to individuals, you have a small radio station here, but here you have a very good local program bringing in local writers, local artists, people who are coming through town, but you have this shift of responsibility as well, where listeners to stations like KSFR really do need to contribute if we're going to continue to have this kind of good, local, intelligent, in-depth coverage.
Which leads me to the following thought, 428-1393.
Good thought. That's right.
give a call, 505-428-1393, because this is, as Tom said, we need to really think about the responsibility here. The kind of ecosystem of community has changed so much because of the shift in the commercial nature of these communities.
It's been a huge shift in power, in that the newspaper or the few big banks, etc., or even in the religious communities, the power is not centered there anymore. The power has shifted to the individual, but with that has come a shift in individual responsibility.
Right.
And we each have to step up and do things like call the station, 428-1393, and make our pledge. And I think you've mentioned it, you can do it on a one-shot deal, write a check, put it on your credit card, whatever it might be, or there are ways to space this out with a contribution on a monthly basis.
A monthly contribution, and I would like to encourage that. I have made monthly, I do make monthly contributions to a number of organizations, including independent media, and if you give, let's say, $10, $15, or $20 a month, I guarantee you that if you are working at all, have any kind of job, you won't notice the disappearance of that, whereas you may notice a chunk if you gave a $200 contribution. That might affect your monthly budget. But if just $15 a month, $10, $15, $20, or more, is a very easy way to do it. And also, it is a very safe way to do it. We have tremendous encryption and data safety around this stuff. So go ahead and do that. Let's get some monthly contributors.
That's right. I would think, too, that it would help the administrative side of the station if you can plan your budget out with some confidence that this is what we're going to have for the next 12 months on a regular basis. Now we can really start to do some strategic planning.
And also, when the next fund drive comes, you can sort of, in a self-satisfied way, say, ah, yes, I'm already contributing.
That's right.
428-1393. The toll-free number is 866-907-5737. Give a call. Give a call right now. Do it. Go for it. So we're talking about government, journalism, open data, citizen participation. And one thing that, of course, comes to mind immediately is that there's a lot of people in government, inevitably, who've got something to hide. And so does the open data movement make it harder for them to hide it, or does it just give them new avenues for obscuring their little misdeeds and corruption and all that kind of stuff?
I would say that we don't know yet. Given the humanity, it's probably a little bit of both. On one hand, there are things that we will be able to see relatively easily, like expenditures, but some things will become more difficult, and as we know, people who want to make mischief will find a way to do that. So, as I say, the answer is not clear.
Now, what about citizen? There's this term going around called citizen journalism. What does that mean?
I think it basically means, well, first is that we should understand that journalists have no special rights to access in the United States that our rights are no different than citizens. The Freedom of Information Act, for example, is journalists use it, but in fact corporations use it to a far greater degree than journalists. What you have are people who are driven, some of them by altruism, who just want to get it down to the basis of what's going on with this voting patterns in our particular state or county, wherever it may be. And so they are concerned with that issue. I think it can tap into things like the League of Women Voters or various good government movements. And now they can be supplied with the data to help make their arguments a little bit stronger. At the same time, frankly, being a journalist does not require a level of skills and training comparable to a neurosurgeon. You have curiosity, be able to ask and frame good questions, be able to not only think critically, but use today's tools to analyze things in a critical manner, and then to report the results. And so what we have is that a very much lowered barriers of entry to being a journalist today. You don't need to own a printing press.
Right.
In fact, sitting here with this $300 laptop that I have, and it has a video camera in it, I can be a global television station, and we can be broadcasting live right now through things like Ustream to colleagues around the world. So the barriers of entry are very low, and people are getting into that. That's where we see the blog movement coming on, for example. Better or worse, there it is.
And at the same time, since anybody can say and do anything they want, it's very cheap to buy a domain name and, you know, call it truthinreporting.org, which may end up being basically your opinions. In other words, how do you know what citizen journalists to trust? And how do these citizen journalists, even the ones who you might think are trustworthy, have the time and money? Yeah, you don't have to have a printing press, but, I mean, one of the problems that we see in journalism is that the amount of money going to investigative journalism is so much lower because of the economic problems of the print newspaper and magazine industry. So, I mean, if the magazines can't pay you to do a reporting job, how can somebody on their own, who's an amateur, do
right.
a good job?
I think a couple of ways. One is by using some of these tools for collaboration. For example, I was doing some training with journalists in Africa a couple of years ago in multiple nations in Africa. And so we focused on here are some ways that you can investigate transborder corruption in southern and eastern Africa. So these journalists were able to take a small piece, their local piece, of a much larger regional story and focus on that and share the information in that way. The other thing is a way that could be happening for investigative journalism, again, is to keep your project small, keep it manageable, and this is something that has not yet happened sufficiently enough in journalism. When you write a story or you broadcast a story, make sure that you give your readers the access to the original data that you used and show them your methodology that you used to reach various conclusions. So a reader can come in and say, well, he or she made a mistake in doing their edition here, and if they had done it correctly, this is what it'd be. So as we,
but it puts a lot of onus on the reader to analyze the analysis.
That's right, readers.
Readers.
Because this is where we get into the interesting self-correcting aspect of blogs or news sites. There are hundreds of thousands that were originally created and then they fall away. On the other hand, there are some that have survived because they have consistently provided accurate information, provided access to the data that was needed so that the people can do their own analysis.
It's actually like a biological evolution model.
Yes, very much so, very much so. And it's expanding, and this is where we get into the complex adaptive system story. We get all of this emergence coming on in the datasphere.
Tom, this is all fascinating, the intersection between complexity science and this whole thing of adaptive systems, biological evolution, self-correcting systems, how we get our news, and realizing that we are in the infancy of this process. And so part of the necessity is for people to adapt to this reality and to understand how it is, to be more participatory in it.
I hope so. I hope that's the case. But as you pointed out, it does take time. I mean, I'm fortunate I'm retired from teaching, and I can spend my time doing this, but people who actually work for a living on a day-to-day basis don't have the time to invest on it. What worries me mostly is that journalism institutions were slow to invest in their own employees' self-education.
It's also, I mean, it seems to me that there is the danger that you have two entirely separate groups of people in this country or in any country. One is the people who participate and have some sense of going on and who are engaged in the process of collecting and analyzing and understanding information in these ways that are not just about turning on the television set, and then this other group of people who's fed the high fructose corn syrup that is cable network news 24 hours a day and don't have the slightest clue.
I certainly agree with you that that's a problem, but it turns out that there are suggestions the problem may even be larger than that. There's a recent study out by the Kettering Institute, which interviewed people all over the country, and they came up to a half a dozen conclusions. One was that for most people, more information does not necessarily about their government does not necessarily, or I'm sorry, governments and or corporations does not necessarily lead to more trust. In fact, it may be generate less trust, partially because Americans are not the most numerate persons. They don't understand data and risk analysis and that kind of thing. So they say, well, if I don't understand it, then I don't trust it. Secondly, the study said that people emphasize that accountability requires an ethical standard, not a statistical standard. And so many governments and many corporations say, well, here's the statistical measure of how we account to people. That is, we held this many open seminars for the public school system or whatever. And the people say, no, what I want is somebody who answers the phone when I call.
Right.
The other factor is that accountability is not the exclusive domain of leaders, but rather the public itself says all individuals in organizations, public or private, need to be held accountable. So this is an emerging, very dynamic, both ethical and cultural system, which is changing rapidly.
Tom Johnson is the co-founder of the Institute for Analytic Journalism. And I think this is just the beginning of a series of conversations that we can have on this subject.
I would love to do it anytime.
And the number is 428-1393, the KSFR Fund Drive, and hoping we can get a report from the control room to see how close we are to our goal of $1,500 for this hour. How are we doing?
Well, we're doing very well. I think we're over 1,200. Still have a little ways to go there. We have Denny Cope to thank.
Thank you.
Along with Sandra Oriel.
Thank you.
And Barbara Cohen, who wants to thank you, especially for your email, Mary Charlotte.
Yay! Yeah, I sent out an email to our listeners. I have a listener list. If you want to be on the listener list, write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. And I will put you on this list, this database. Talk about data. Tom Johnson, you get the last word.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here in this fundraising effort. I think that your program is not only is it unique, but it plays the game at a higher level, a higher intellectual level than much of the media does. And I appreciate the fact that you are constantly inviting interesting people, and I hope I'm one of them, but,
yeah,
but also asking interesting questions. And that's the challenge in the media today, is to not just simply be provocative for its own sake, but to try to drill down into topics in a variety of ways that does enrich the community and its understanding of what we do have here in northern New Mexico, which is so special. So everybody who does make these contributions, we appreciate very much by calling 428-1393.
See, and he's got the number memorized.
That's right, almost.
428, oh, he's got a cheat sheet.
I've got a cheat sheet. 428-1393, local here in Santa Fe, and make those calls and keep those phones ringing.
I thought what you said earlier was really important about the responsibility of the individual. We talk about rights, we talk about responsibilities, but it's not just the kind of responsibilities we have to play by the rules, which is a way of thinking about responsibility, but a responsibility to the organizations and the infrastructures that make democracy possible. And I think the media, the various media, are part of that infrastructure that make it possible for citizens to know who they're voting for, to know what's going on around them, to know what they want to support, to know what they want to protest. We're living in an era of protests right now, which is very interesting.
That's right. And you mentioned the word infrastructure, and we traditionally think of that as being roads and sewers and public safety falls into that in some ways, educational systems, but also an important part of the infrastructure is this communications infrastructure, which makes it possible to address local issues in a insightful and timely way. So stations like KSFR are actually the vehicle to help us do that.
428-1393 is the number, 428-1393. Now, did we, Mary Lynn, did we have a, did you say a number that we were up to? Anyway, I think what's happening is Mary Lynn is going back and forth between the control room and the studio where the telephones are ringing and where the very nice volunteers are standing by. And when the phones aren't ringing, they eat bonbons. So we really try to get the phones to ring. 428-1393.
I wish I had a bonbon in my mouth right now.
So what are we up to? Have we hit 1,500?
We have not hit 1,500. I think we need about $300 more. There's a couple people on phones right now, but there are other phones that can be answered. There are people standing by to answer them.
428-1393. 428-1393.
And Anonymous to thank, and Malong Baldwin.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And Anonymous is one of our great contributors. Anonymous has contributed during every fund drive, and Anonymous is also one of the great artists in the history of art. 428-1393 is the number. Keep your public media alive. And so, Tom, just remind us about your event at Santa Fe Complex.
Yes, I'm giving a lecture, a presentation tomorrow night, Wednesday night, at 7:15 at the Santa Fe Complex. We'll be talking about this emerging global movement of open data, where, as I said earlier, people literally all over the world in countries where you wouldn't expect have become aware and skillful enough at the broad digital media to be able to tell their governments, hey, that's our data that you've been spending our tax money on. We want to have access to it as well. And it's not necessarily, in fact, it's rarely about private personal data, but rather it's about data pertaining to government broadly defined. So everything from what money is being spent in the city of San Antonio, Texas, again, each month for various projects and where is it being spent is being accessed, but at a larger venue, as I said, people looking at the instances of disease or a vaccination on a nationwide basis.
One of my dreams that I don't think will ever be realized is to get a true budget of the United States of America that includes explicitly where our money goes.
How about if we start with the city of Santa Fe? right there. And get it promptly in forms that we could analyze the data and the flow of that money.
Yeah, that would be nice.